We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. The producer for Focus is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Kyle Mabry. Today we open the phone lines and the email message folder for questions about diet and nutrition. Our guest is licensed registered dietitian Susan Kundrot. Listeners, I look forward to your phone calls and email messages for Susan. Here are the phone numbers. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Susan is a sports and wellness nutritionist and president of Nutrition on the Move. She's an adjunct lecturer with the University of Illinois Food Science and Human Nutrition Department. She is the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. She's also the sports dietitian for Illini Athletics and leads nutrition and cooking classes at the Activities and Recreation Center on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Questions about diet, nutrition, health, and wellness are invited this morning. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. The email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Welcome back. Happy December.
Happy December. A cold one.
It sure is. 17 degrees currently.
Wow.
Sunny, brisk.
Yes.
And the holidays are ahead. Actually, we've come through a couple already.
We have.
So, the question is, how do we keep on track in that moderation groove? Because
right.
I think that's the key to the whole thing, to enjoy yourself but not to overdo.
It really is, because it's a fun time of year and we should be enjoying the parties and enjoying the different types of foods that are available. And I think it's really important, the tradition of food and cookie baking and all those things, because that's a fun way to enjoy being together with family and friends and things too. So as you say, the question is, how do you do that and still be moderate with what you're taking in? I think one thing is to realize that you don't necessarily need to eat everything to enjoy everything. So there's a lot of fun in seeing the food and making the food and baking cookies and smelling them and maybe having a few, but you don't necessarily have to feel like you have to eat a whole ton of them to enjoy them. So kind of being aware that there's a lot of things we get out of the food around the holidays that doesn't necessarily mean we have to consume it all,
mm-hmm.
which sometimes we forget because we just get used to maybe eating more than we need to. And I think there are some strategies that we can think about for kind of planning ahead and making sure that you're staying on a good kind of nutrition plan yourself during the holidays. I mean, there are certainly reasons why we might overeat. And one of those is because maybe we're not eating as well to begin with. Our schedules are a little erratic. Mm-hmm. Maybe if people skip breakfast, for example, they're much more apt to eat more of the other things that are available. So if you go to a meeting in the morning and you have skipped breakfast, you might eat two donuts because they're there.
They're there. And you're hungry.
And you're hungry. So I think the whole idea of really trying to stay on an eating schedule where you're not skipping meals during the holidays is really, really important, because that allows yourself, at least from a hunger standpoint, to not necessarily need as much of the extra food. And it's much easier to choose maybe your favorite thing rather than having more than you need. So there might be something you really, really love during the holidays. You might have one of those and be satisfied with it because you're not necessarily hungry. And so that's a big help. I think the other thing, you know, that we want to make sure we do, I guess, from a broad standpoint, is to stay as active as possible, knowing that, I mean, it's definitely harder when we get weather like this and it's a little bit harder.
Sidewalks are icy and whatnot.
Exactly. But to really try to maintain some activity, even if you're trying to get together with friends and you meet at an indoor mall and you're walking and having coffee too, or you're doing something where you're trying to keep some of the activity going, because part of what happens during the holidays for a lot of people is their calorie intake goes up, maybe 500 or 1,000 on a typical day. If their activity doesn't go up, then they end up saying, well, gosh, in maybe 3 or 4 weeks, I have put on 5 or 8 pounds or something like that. And so you can kind of think about compensating that a little bit by trying to plan things where at least you're walking. You're getting a little bit more activity so that you're just maybe burning a few more calories than you normally would on a typical day, too. Mm-hmm. And that really helps a lot.
Yeah. How can we avoid packing so many calories into one meal, which is that seems to be, a tough nut to crack? Because last time when you were here, it was ahead of Thanksgiving. And I think you said that the typical Thanksgiving dinner is like 1,500 calories.
Right. Right.
So that's a lot, and that puts a lot of stress on your body take all that in at one time.
Right.
So what's the key to a healthy plate for a holiday festive meal?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a few things are really important. One thing, if you're looking at just the volume that you eat and trying to bring down the calories in that volume, is really looking for foods that you can choose, whatever meal you're at, that are lower calories. So certainly if there is something like steamed green beans, it may be that you don't take a little bit of that, but you take a lot of that. So maybe a third of your plate is steamed green beans so that you still have stuffing and mashed potatoes and turkey or whatever you might have, but you just don't have that many calories if you're doing that. And I think another thing, because a lot of times we'll do holiday meals and people will go back for seconds. And most people will say, and myself included, I really didn't need that. You know, I didn't need that second plate. So maybe going into a meal knowing that, well, I'm just going to have one plate. That's what I'm going to eat. And then I'll kind of wait to see if I really want dessert or if I do try to have a smaller piece of dessert. That's really helpful because a lot of times we just eat volumes because it's there. Mm-hmm. And so kind of planning ahead and saying, well, one plate's probably enough for me. I'll make sure I get really what I want, plus any way that I can get some additional veggies or salad or fruit or something on there is a big help.
Yeah.
In doing that, kind of makes it so that we still enjoy the meal, but we're not getting nearly the calories that we would normally take in. I think the other thing is a lot of holiday meals just tend to be really high on the starches. And, you know, holidays can be very stressful for people who have to watch their carbohydrate intake, people with diabetes or hypoglycemia or other issues, because so many of these foods that we typically see, like breads and stuffing and corn and potatoes and all these things, are very high in carbohydrate. So it's important to be aware of maybe saying, oh, I don't need maybe a roll and potatoes and stuffing and corn at the same meal, but I might choose two of the starches. And maybe I really love stuffing because I hardly ever get that. I'll have that and some corn and keep it to my vegetable and my meat. So that helps too.
Yeah. And we have to remember that if people don't go back for a second plate, it's not because they don't love the cook.
Right, exactly.
You ever have that?
Oh, yes.
Pressure put on you?
Yes.
What's wrong with you?
Right.
You're not eating.
Mm-hmm.
I've had enough. Thank you.
It
was wonderful. It was delicious. But
you know, and there are things you can do as the host or the hostess for a meal, too. I mean, you can make sure that you put out smaller plates. I mean, you don't necessarily have to have the biggest plates available. So if you're putting out smaller plates, then people are apt to eat less. We know that from many studies that we eat based on the amount that we can carry in our plate. We've seen that happen here at the U of I dining halls with the trayless system. So now that the dining halls have a trayless system where our students here on campus can't have a big tray that they take through, the food intake goes down by about a third.
Really?
And so consumption goes down considerably. Most studies indicate by about a third it goes down. And food waste, of course, is cut way down. So you've got two really good things happening. But in general, college students eat tremendously less food. So fewer calories, partly because they have to keep going back. Now, at first, it's a little bit of a pain when you're having to do that. But there's only so much you can carry. So generally, by the time you've eaten that, you've sat down to eat, you may not really need the rest of it, so you don't often go back.
Right.
So,
yeah, if you're in the line, it looks like a good thing, and you keep putting it out. Well, that looks good. That looks good.
It's very easy to do that. So I think if you're hosting a meal or hosting a party, that's something to keep in mind. A couple things you can do is make sure there are fruits and vegetables available. I mean, even something simple. We got a lot of people are getting grapefruit and oranges now from different organizations. So we had our delivery yesterday, and I just cut up one of the oranges and one of the grapefruit and put it on a plate. We had it with dinner last night. And actually, you know, an orange and a grapefruit cut up into sections, both of them, makes a quite a bit of fruit to see there. And I was thinking just having that whole plate of fruit, which we ate the whole thing, and having that available, where people are generally going to eat that if you have it out. And that's just a pretty combination right there, even if you slice oranges and slice grapefruit. And how simple that would be if someone was having people over and just slice up a bunch of fresh fruit and have that available too. And so we just end up eating, you know, many, many fewer calories simply because you're eating more produce. And that's an easy thing to kind of remember during the holidays. Really bump up the produce.
This is Focus from Illinois Public Media on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good morning. I'm Celeste Quinn, our guest in this portion of the program, licensed registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you this morning. Join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. And let's talk about now, I think, why don't we talk about the news about vitamin D? Because there was a very interesting story about getting too much vitamin D. We've been on kind of a vitamin D craze. We've been told we don't get enough, and now we're being told, hold on, you need to get the right amount, but don't go overboard. So a group of researchers said most people have adequate amounts of vitamin D in their blood supplied by their diets and natural sources like sunshine. So what is the recommendation, or what are the current recommendations? And I think it depends on your age and health.
Right. Well, I think and we've talked about this before, I think the number one thing is no one knows what their vitamin D status is until you get it checked. So everyone should have, you know, if there's any concern, you should talk to your physician and seek a vitamin D blood test, because, and you can then be told, are you within the normal recommendations for your age, and do you really need more supplementation? So I certainly do get questions. A lot of times people will call and say, well, I'm trying to get more vitamin D. What should I take? And my question back to them would be, well, do you really need more vitamin D?
What are you so needing?
That's, right. So that's number one, to make sure that you're actually low in vitamin D. Now, of course, in the more northern areas where we live, more people tend to be lower in vitamin D because we don't get as much sunshine, or the sunshine we get is not as strong as if you lived in the southern states. So that is, you know, one thing where we might have more problems up here. But the NIH did come out with new recommendations, and the recommendations have increased in terms of the amount to take in during a day than what they had been in the past. So it's 600 IUs of vitamin D up to age 70, and 800 IUs 71 and older. So that's increased. Some of the recommendations were as low as 200 IUs before this. And so, you know, in some cases it's doubled or tripled in terms of the recommended amount. So, again, that's kind of general. Anytime we have these USDA recommendations or NIH recommendations, you know, they're really general population recommendations. So people need to recognize that they're not really specific for individual needs. You do need to make sure you're tested and find out if your levels are low. I mean, obviously there's been all this interest in vitamin D for many, many concerns. We always think about bone health, and we think that, yeah, vitamin D has to be with calcium to help you absorb calcium and have strong bone. Vitamin D is part of bone strength. But we also know that it's you know, helpful to have adequate levels of vitamin D, perhaps to decrease risk of certain cancers like colorectal cancer and other things in the body. So, but like anything else, I mean, vitamin D, if we think about what it is, it's A, D, E, and K, or fat-soluble vitamins, which means that when we take them in, they're more apt to be stored in the body rather than, say, vitamin C or B vitamins that generally they can be toxic too, but we get rid of those when we go to the bathroom. So they get formed into our urine, and you know, we generally get rid of the excess. So because it's a fat-soluble vitamin, you have to think, well, you know, it would stay in your system, be more apt to stay in your system, which is a good thing if you're low, but not so good if you have too much vitamin D. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So babies, 400 IU, and then for the rest of us until we reach age 70, 600, and adults 71 years and older, 800, and that's the recommendation. But now some people have been so crazy about vitamin D, mm-hmm. they've been taking a lot more, double that. So maybe we need to calm down.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the concerns, I saw a program recently about vitamin D intake and how so many foods are supplemented or fortified with vitamin D now, too, to just be aware that many people may, if their levels are normal and you have milk and you have yogurt and you have some other things during the day, you might easily get the 600 or 800 IUs just in foods that mm-hmm. you take in and not necessarily need to take an additional supplement to get up to that level.
Let's take some calls. Susan Kundrat is our guest this morning here on Focus. She's a nutritionist. She is the author of 101 Sports Nutrition Tips. She is the sports dietitian for Illini Athletics, and she is president of Nutrition on the Move. My name is Celeste Quinn. Let's go and talk with some listeners now. Our first caller this morning joins us from McLean County on line one. Hi.
Morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I have a couple of questions, and I'll make them as brief as possible. First one, I hear this over and over again about how coffee is good for you. Does that include instant coffee, or does it have to be brewed or whatever else they do, you know, the liquids and things?
Mm-hmm. Well, to answer that question, most of the studies on coffee that I'm aware of are with brewed coffee. Not to say that instant coffee isn't good for you, but it's kind of like tea. Almost all the studies on the benefits of tea uh-huh. are on brewed tea. And recently there was a review that looked at iced teas and different other teas and found very minimal amount of antioxidants in those teas as compared to brewed tea. So I think if we think about, you know, drinking coffee for the potential benefits, the studies I'm aware of are on brewed coffee. Again, maybe that there's some benefits in instant coffee as well, but the brewed coffee is where most of the studies originate.
Okay. Maybe we should ask these people to include the decaf as well. I mean, the decaf and the mm-hmm. instant both.
Yeah, some of the beneficial studies have not just been on caffeinated coffee, but on decaffeinated coffee too, because coffee itself and the coffee beans do contain nutrients like antioxidants as well, just like tea does. And so even if it's a decaffeinated product, there have, you know, been some beneficial results with coffee. And I guess I would say with coffee or tea or anything that if you do have the caffeinated version of that, just to be aware that there are going to be people who really don't respond well to it simply if you take the caffeinated amount or the caffeinated type and have changes in heart rate or blood pressure or things like that. So you know, there will be people that it doesn't really help, but we've seen some positive studies looking at different things like Parkinson's risk reduction and diabetes risk reduction and things like that with coffee, and some of those have been decaf as well.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that's good to know, because that was one of my questions. But I would really like to see some stuff in instant, only because I do better with instant than brewed coffee. And mm-hmm. That's a different story. Okay. The next question is about yogurt. When you use yogurt, if you buy plain yogurt and make your own and add vegetables to it or fruit to it, you know, to make a salad, mm-hmm. does that take away from the culture or the probiotic qualities?
Well, I don't believe that it does. I mean, when you take in yogurt, if you add, so you're just saying, let's say you buy yogurt or you make it yourself and then you add fruit to it.
Or
vegetables and make a salad or something. Mm-hmm. No, because the components, as far as I know, the components that are in the yogurt would certainly be active when you eat that yogurt, even if you've got something else in it.
Okay.
So, again, I'm not a food scientist, so I don't know. There may be some changes that occur. But from what I understand, you can eat yogurt, have other things with it, and still get the benefit of the probiotic benefit of yogurt. And by the way, that, you know, it's a good question, because I think we're seeing a lot more interest in things like yogurt and probiotics because of the interest in just keeping your gut healthy in general,
right? Yeah.
Whether with fibers or yogurts or things like that. So it's a great addition to the diet.
And I've noticed that the probiotics nowadays, you can buy them refrigerated or non-refrigerated.
Mm-hmm.
And the yogurt has to be refrigerated. So I'm wondering, is the non-refrigerated probiotic still as good? I mean, how do you keep the culture alive?
Mm-hmm. Well, there, you know, that's a big question and kind of a controversy. There have been a few studies that have compared different types of probiotics and looked at the quality. And I think in general, a good way to go is to have a refrigerated product. But I think there's still a lot we don't know about how strong some of these different probiotics are, the different strains. And, you know, the other thing to keep in mind is that some people respond better to certain strains than other strains. And so it may be that you try some different products and see how you feel personally. And if you notice a difference in terms of gas and in terms of gastrointestinal health yourself, because we're all different in terms of the types of, bacteria we have in our gut.
Mm-hmm.
And so they might work better for different people.
Okay, well, great. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks for the call this morning. Next, we talk with a listener in Mattoon on Line 2. Hi. Line 2?
Hello?
Hi, go ahead.
Thank you. I think I missed part of your comments on vitamins, and I'm interested in folic or phthalic, whatever it is, acid. The daily requirements, and now I'm over 85, and I wondered, you know, what the difference was.
Well, with folic acid, I think, you know, a couple things we might say. First, with folic acid is a B vitamin, so it's a B vitamin that has been looked at, pretty consistently for a lot of things. We think about folic acid being helpful for decreasing birth defects and things like that. I'm trying to find the actual amount of folic acid. There's been some concern lately with folic acid that maybe some people are getting too much, because it's another one of those vitamins that's actually been added to a lot of different foods. And so what we generally say for many vitamins like folic acid is we kind of recommend that people get, if they take it in a multivitamin, they get 100% of the recommended amount for your age, and I can give you that here in a second. And you don't necessarily take more unless you need more. Now, there have been some studies that have looked at the benefits of folic acid, maybe with preventing heart disease. And so sometimes you'll see folic acid added into kind of a heart vitamin or heart vitamin mineral type thing. But the one thing that we do know is that we want to make sure that you don't get too much of it. Generally, the recommended amount, and let me get you that here.
Yeah,
if you've got
let me think. I've got it.
Okay.
Okay. Males and females, 19 years and older, 400.
That would be micrograms.
Day. Okay. And, yep. If you're a pregnant woman, 600.
Well, if I am, it'll be one for the book.
Well, maybe somebody else out there is listening and is interested for their own situation.
Exactly.
Yes. So thanks for the question. Anything else we can tell you today?
No, I think that's it. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. And also on this little fact sheet that I found online, breakfast cereals fortified, you know, there are a lot of fortified cereals out there. And a 3/4 cup gets you 400 micrograms. So that's 100%. So it doesn't, apparently it doesn't take much to make sure you're on target. Right.
And I think one of the concerns of folic acid, with the 400 micrograms kind of as a general recommendation, the tolerable upper intake level, which we usually consider the tolerable upper level, is 1,000 micrograms a day. That would be in supplement form, exclusive of what you'd get in food, because food, actual natural food form, is absorbed a little bit different. Things that are high in folate food-wise, we usually think of greens. So we think of things like spinach and dark lettuce, which have maybe 50 to 100 micrograms, mm-hmm. oranges, nuts and seeds, things like that. But just to be aware that, you know, when you take it in a cereal, that is a supplement. And then if you take it in a multivitamin, often that's 400 again that you might get, or 100% generally they'll put in. So just be aware that you might have other many ways that you get additional folic acid.
This is interesting. 4 spears of asparagus get you 85 micrograms.
That's pretty high.
Yeah. Well, what do you say we take another call? This is a listener on line 3 in Urbana. Good morning.
Hello.
Hi there.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Okay. A couple years ago, I was diagnosed as kind of a pre-diabetes, slipping into diabetes. Everything is well controlled. I'm on an oral medication. I have, however, noticed a difference if I put 3 things and watch which ones bump up my blood sugar after eating.
Mm-hmm.
Rice seems to be the main culprit versus potatoes and pasta. Allowing for, you know, good portion control, which doesn't always happen, but let's say it does.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything in rice that would really, you know, be bumping that up higher than say, an equal amount of potatoes or spaghetti?
Well, I guess I would ask, is it usually white rice that you eat, or do you eat brown rice or whole grain rice?
Generally basmati white rice, yeah.
Okay. Well, the white rice itself is a pretty easily digested carbohydrate. It's kind of a quick sugar carbohydrate, and so that may be why you're seeing that. You know, we call it maybe a, depending upon the type of rice it is, it may have a higher glycemic index, meaning it'll kind of turn to sugar more faster or more quickly than other carbohydrates. And so, and the other thing with rice is that because it's so dense in calories, that, you know, serving really is only about a third a cup or so of cooked rice, which is not very much. So there may be 2 things going on. It's real easy to eat considerably more rice than that, even if you're watching portions, because it's just, you know, an easy food to eat.
Right.
And if it is basmati or any kind of white rice or refined rice like that, then it does tend to kind of raise blood sugars in some people more quickly. Potatoes have more starch, a different type of starch. And so in some people, potatoes really, raise blood sugar very quickly. But in other people, it does take a little longer. The other thing is what you have with it. Whenever you eat a carbohydrate or a starch, if you're looking at blood sugar, the way your body responds is also going to depend on what all you've eaten with it. So sometimes potatoes don't raise blood sugar as much in certain people because they might have butter with it or sour cream or something that slows down the absorption or the digestion of that food in the stomach.
Oh, I see.
And so often with rice, we might eat it plain. We may not, you know, have something on it that is going to slow down how fast that gets digested. So whenever you add a fat or if you add more protein to the meal, even if you've got a high glycemic index carb like rice, it generally gets absorbed, you know, digested more slowly. So I guess that's one thing I would suggest. If you use rice, maybe think of it as more of a condiment in the meal. So if it is a stir fry and you have a little more protein and you have more vegetables and a little bit of rice with it,
yeah,
it may be fine for you. But if it's kind of a main side dish or a main starch, it may cause you more trouble, because you've got more of it and it's just a real quick digesting carb. We kind of think of rice as one of those foods that the body can handle really easily. We think of that sort of the brat diet if someone's sick or has gastrointestinal problems, with rice being part of that. And one reason is that the body generally digests that pretty easily and quickly.
And quickly.
Okay. Right.
I do a lot of Indian cooking and that sort of thing. So that's where I was noticing it. And I was thinking, if I soaked, which is really the correct way to cook the basmati, is to soak it for a long time and then rinse all that off and then cook it.
Mm-hmm.
Would that help get rid of some of that starch?
Well, it may get rid of some of it. I don't know that it would necessarily change how your body reacts. I would say the biggest thing would be the amount you take in.
Okay.
So still use it. And the basmati has that nice flavor, that nice nutty flavor. And
right.
It's so good with Indian meals.
Yeah.
And so, you know, having a really hearty brown rice doesn't necessarily maybe do the same thing with some of those dishes. But obviously that'd be best, because then you get more fiber and the body has to take longer to digest it. But I would say maybe cut the amount you have in half and bump up your veggies or your protein at the meal and see how that works for you. But that's great that you're monitoring like that and seeing how your body reacts to different types of carbohydrates. That's fantastic. That's what you want to be doing.
Oh, well, thank you. And thank you very much for your answer.
Thanks for the call. Next, we're going to talk with a listener in St. Joseph, line 1. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question. I have 2 grandchildren that are
in the 18, 19-year-old range. And the granddaughter cannot eat breakfast anymore. She just feels nauseous when she eats a breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And the grandson he's just not eating, really. I mean, he played soccer for many years and was really, really active, and then he had an injury that he couldn't really play it that much anymore. And he's just kind of, like at Thanksgiving, he came to my house, and he didn't eat anything the whole time he was there. And he's done that different times. He just doesn't eat. He said it just makes him feel nauseous.
Hmm.
And afraid he's eating quite a bit of, well, snack food. I'm not sure exactly what, but I knew at Thanksgiving he said, well, he had eaten, one of the nutrition bars or what before he came, but that shouldn't keep him from eating all day.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think anytime somebody is having trouble eating, if they really are having trouble getting real solid meals and things like that, it's definitely, if they would, it's definitely good to get that checked out medically with their physician. There may be, there's always a possibility that there's something going on stomach-wise or gastrointestinally or something like that that's really causing the nausea or making it difficult to digest food or something like that. So that would, I would definitely rule that out for sure. And then I think some of the other things is, it may be that, particularly at that age group, young adults or kids get into kind of habits with nutrition where they're just not as used to eating big meals, or they're used to kind of eating on the run. And even with the breakfast idea with your granddaughter, that's not that unusual. But what I would suggest she does is just get up, get around, get some water in the morning, and then maybe an hour or two later try to have breakfast. Because for a lot of people, they don't feel, maybe their gut's not awake yet. They're not awake yet, so they don't feel like eating much right away. But
yeah, of course, she lives in the country, so she's got to get a bus, which is like an hour before school starts. So there's not all that much time is what I'm afraid of.
Yeah.
Too.
And, she may do okay with doing something like taking a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and having that at the end of the bus ride. And for a lot of kids I know who ride the bus quite a while, they don't want to eat beforehand because it might make their stomach jumpy. But maybe once she gets to school, she could eat that, and that'd be fine, you know. But she could certainly...
Even one of the nutrition bars, would that...
Yeah, I mean, that'd be...
Not really into peanut butter.
Yeah, that'd be a good option if she wanted to try that. Even something like the smaller Special K protein bar or something like that with a piece of fruit or something.
Yeah, I know. I've told my son and daughter-in-law that they really need to get him checked out because he said something about his bones, maybe. And I know, but is it true that by age 21 you stop growing bone?
Well, what happens as you get into your early 20s and sometimes even younger is your body kind of gets out of the building phase and just starts replenishing or kind of trying to keep bone, but not necessarily building bone. And that's why we say how important it is for kids and young teens to really bump up the protein and the calcium and the vitamin D and all these things that affect bone, because you can only build it so long and then you're just trying to keep it the rest of your life.
Yeah, that's what I'm so concerned about.
But I think it'd be worth getting a medical evaluation to find out if there's something else going on.
Okay. They say they will.
Yeah.
It hasn't happened yet anyway. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. This is Focus. This morning, our guest, licensed registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. We'll take another call now. This is a listener in Lafayette, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Without considering diabetic effects particularly, what would you say to a gulp of, do it with a meal, a gulp of something acid, maybe tomato juice, just to control the glycemic effect?
Well, there certainly have been, there's been interest in looking at that, or looking at even, for a lot of people, they'll take a little bit of something acidic or even something like vinegar to change the acid-base balance as you're eating. I don't know that, you know, I guess I would back up and say, you know, physiologically, the body and the stomach, what goes into the stomach, you know, our bodies kind of take care of that pretty well. And they, you know, it actually breaks down and digests that. So there's, you know, the question would be, does it really, if you bump up the acid with what you eat, does it really change how the stomach's going to view that food? And some people say yes, and some people say no. You know, the body's going to handle it like it would normally handle it. So that being said, my experience working with people with blood sugar regulation concerns or diabetes or things is that really not everybody responds the same way. And so if it's something, you know, you'd want to try and you could see and monitor how you feel, your blood sugars or that kind of thing, as long as it's healthy and not causing any problem, it's worth trying. Because I do think that we're all different in how we respond to what we do with food. The other thing with something like tomato juice is I've had clients who will add tomato juice. Obviously, that adds more acidity as an acidic food. It also adds something that is kind of bulky, has more fiber, but doesn't really have many calories at all. So there might be secondary benefits to doing something like tomato juice when you're eating a meal, because you take up some of the bulk and the space for that meal with something that is very low calorie, too.
All right. Thank you, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for the call this morning. And now we have a couple of questions that have come to us from a listener by email. First of all, the listener says, thanks for your past advice on probiotics for gut health. And that has been very helpful.
Great.
For this listener. And question one, are the yogurt capsules available in health food stores effective? The listener says this is easier and less expensive than the yogurt, that is the probiotic.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, again, I think many of the capsule forms of yogurt capsules or the probiotic capsules or the probiotic pills or pearls or all the things that are out there do work well. And so I would try them. I guess I would say not everything works for everybody. It's kind of like different yogurts. I might have clients who don't feel good taking one certain type of yogurt, but then another type works for them because it has a little different strain of probiotic or strain of bacteria that seems for them to give them more relief. So I would say if the yogurt capsules, I would try and see how you feel with that and see if you notice any difference or if you feel like, hey, this works just as well as yogurt for me, so I may be fine. Because one of the challenges, you know, we really recommend getting yogurt in every day for most people and changing the brand, because for, again, you might respond well to different types of brands and trying things out, but that's not feasible for everybody. It's just like certain foods are not feasible to take in, and some people do better, you know, taking it in a supplemental form or something. So I would say try it and see how you do with it. I think I mentioned maybe a year or two ago when we were talking about this that, you know, I've talked with people who actually study these probiotics, and they say it's really kind of difficult to study each particular brand in each particular box or container of it to know how active is that actual one. And so I think it is somewhat of a trial and error to see, you know, what's active and what's available in that.
Okay. And this listener would like any other advice you might have for holding the line on flatulence.
Yeah. Well, I think a couple different things. I think you can look at what types of foods you're eating and how they're cooked. So, for example, foods that tend to make us pretty gassy, things like cauliflower and broccoli. And many of my clients say, well, gosh, I'm eating so much better now, but I'm having more trouble with gas or with flatulence. And so you might say, well, if you have broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, anything like that, maybe steam cook them at least for a short while. Don't have them raw, because sometimes if they're raw, they tend to have a lot more gas and maybe even indigestion and things like that. But if they're even cooked for a minute or two, whether that's thrown in water for a short time or cooked in the microwave or just steam cooked very briefly, for many people that breaks down or gets rid of some of the gases and breaks down some of the tissue in the vegetable enough that helps. Same thing for beans. If you're making beans, maybe you soak them a little bit longer. Make sure that you rinse the water several times if you're making your own beans, cooking your own beans, so that you don't actually cook anything that has some water from the beans where it's been soaked. And trying things like Beano and some of those products.
Is that really an enzyme product, Beano?
Yeah, it's an enzyme product.
Because that's the listener wanted to know about, you know, like trying an enzyme.
Yeah, you could try the Beano, or you could try, there are kind of broad enzymes that you can buy that are, you know, gastrointestinal enzymes, or kind of an enzyme that maybe has some, you know, enzymes that help break down carbohydrate in particular when you take in food. You know, those work for some people, not for everyone. Usually if you're taking an enzyme supplement, you'd want to make sure that it's coated in such a way that it can get through the stomach. And so many of the good products do have a particular coating on them that they're not going to necessarily be broken down as well in the stomach, or some of that can continue to go on through the gut. But there have also been some studies indicating that some of those work well, some of them really don't. So it's kind of an individual. But I'd say try different things and see, because something might work for you that doesn't work for someone else.
Yeah. Well, apparently the listener had good luck with the yogurt, so that's good.
That's great.
This is Focus on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest in this portion of the program is licensed registered dietitian Susan Kundra. Listeners, you can join us this morning with a phone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-9455. WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Anything strike you as interesting in the news recently as far as diet and nutrition goes, Susan?
Well, I guess when I've looked at what's coming out, I've seen a lot of new reports looking at, but we still see a lot of things on obesity, right? And
right.
And a lot of the recommendations coming out with obesity. And one of the things that I think is promising is that, you know, there is a big push now to really try to look at what kids are eating in particular, and more of the information that's coming out about the school lunches, and trying to, you know, make some real change there, which I think is really, really positive. I think, you know, the big concern we have is a lot of people not eating well and not teaching their kids to eat well. And if you think about particularly, you know, the changes that need to happen in school lunches or school breakfasts, that may be for a lot of kids two of their meals and maybe two only meals they're eating, you know, during the day. And so I think we're, you know, we've seen a lot of debate back and forth in the last month or two, I guess, in the news about that. But I think it's real positive if we can see some of these changes coming through from children on. And I think we need to, you know, personally really need to keep supporting that, because we know that we develop our habits when we're young.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this all the time with college students and college athletes I work with, where for some of them, they come here to the U of I and it's really not difficult for them to make the adjustment being a college student and choosing what they need, because they're just so used to eating balanced meals. And if they're used to eating balanced meals, they know what that looks like on the plate. They're looking for a fruit and vegetable. They're not eating a lot of greasy stuff. They're not eating necessarily a lot of fast food, because that's just what they grew up with. And I think that's what plays out. That's what we've got to get to, is trying to make that easier for young adults when they're then making their own choices with food, to have things be the norm to eat fairly balanced and fairly healthy. I mean, there's obviously a lot of other things that come into play with that economically and things, but so I'm real pleased to see the continued push to try to get some of those things going.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. Could you say something about confectionery sugar? It seems that it doesn't have to be refrigerated, and it's on Christmas cookies, and it's on cupcakes. And is there any substitute that people could sculpt their things without having to have a gob of sugar?
Well, I think when you look at a lot of the holiday treats and those kinds of things, one type of, you know, let's say cookie or dessert that doesn't necessarily need to have as much sugar or take as much sugar is when you had more of the spice. And so particularly things that have more cinnamon or more allspice or that kind of thing, often there's enough flavor in that that you really don't have to have as much sugar. And so that's one option. And I think, you know, the thing with sugar is that we just get used to eating quite a bit of it. And so the nice thing about even the powdered sugar is even adding a little bit of that adds a little sweet, but really virtually no calories or very few calories if it's just a little bit sprinkled on top. And so maybe considering that, I always think of my mom who used to make brownies and she'd just put a little powdered sugar on top instead of frosting a lot of the time.
Uh-huh.
And then the sugar intake goes way down. So some of that is, does the sweet or does the treat that you have enough flavor in itself that it doesn't really need a lot of extra sweet or a lot of extra sugar? And, you know, and that's beneficial. I think we see that with things like desserts with berries or even pumpkin or that kind of thing, because there can be some spice in there and there can be some flavor naturally. So I guess that's something that people can think about doing is, you know, do you really have to frost something or do you really have to add that if it's got enough flavor to begin with?
I can put a little piece of fruit on the top of it or something like that, but then the criticism is that that can't be refrigerated. That has to be refrigerated.
Right.
It doesn't last for a week.
Right, exactly. And so that's where maybe even a little bit of the powdered sugar is nice, because it's a teeny bit of a sweet, but not really much.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Next, we take a call from a listener in Chicago. Line 4, hello.
Hello, I was going to call about the diabetes. I have a relative who has the type 2 diabetes, and I found that not so much the, well, it is, you know, we watch the starches and the, you know, sugary things, the sweets, but mm-hmm. it seems to be, the main culprit seems to be the fat. If she sticks to a low-fat, high-fiber diet, she keeps it pretty well under control. But, you know, when you get a lot of fatty foods or junk foods, you know, hot dogs, you know, stuff you buy outside,
mm-hmm.
You know, really her sugar really skyrockets. And I think that, you know, that's been the key for her, and she can keep it pretty well under control if she just watches the fat.
Well, that's great. I mean, and obviously if you're taking in a lot more fat, then usually you're taking in a lot more calories. And that may, you know, obviously that can affect blood sugar too, because if you're just taking in a lot of extra calories when you eat, it's harder for the body to kind of process that. And obviously it brings up a really good point that more fiber and less fat in what you eat in general is just so important for diabetes, because we know that diabetes and heart disease kind of run hand in hand. And so when you do have diabetes, your risk of heart disease is higher and vice versa. So watching the fat intake is a really important part of the diabetic diet for type 2 or for type 1 diabetes, both. And so that's good. And my guess is she's probably taking in then fewer calories at a time with a much lower fat diet, and the body's much more apt to process that. And then when you've added the fiber in, that takes a little longer to digest and is better for the system too. And we know that certain fibers, like gummy fibers, beans, and certain fruits and vegetables may actually help decrease blood sugar because of their gumminess that they have. So that sounds like a good plan.
We found that, like, for as far as beans, like green beans seem to be very helpful as far as for vegetables.
Mm-hmm. Green beans are great because their total carbohydrate intake amount is very low. But if you eat considerable amount of green beans, you get a lot of fiber. And so that's great. Yeah. And a lot of fluid, a lot of water, so you're staying better hydrated too.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call this morning. This is Focus, and our guest today is Susan Kundrat of Nutrition on the Move. She is the sports dietitian for Illini Athletics, and she is an adjunct lecturer with the University of Illinois Food Science and Human Nutrition Department. This is a topic that we take up on the second Wednesday of the month. And Susan joins us in the 10 o'clock hour of Focus. My name is Celeste Quinn. We have a couple minutes left, 1 or 2 minutes left, maybe not enough really to invite a lot of callers in, so I won't do that.
Okay.
Fair enough. But maybe we could talk briefly here. I thought this was interesting. I brought this into the studio this morning. This is, we were talking a little bit about child nutrition, and Congress gave final approval to a child nutrition bill that expands the school lunch program and sets some new standards. And there's a little graphic here on this article. This comes from the Center for Science and the Public Interest. Okay, when we get this remake on the school lunch, for example, if today we have a fried chicken patty, in the future we'll have a barbecued chicken patty. And if we have a white roll today, coming in the near future, a whole grain roll. Canned green beans today, locally grown carrots tomorrow might be on the plate. Whole milk now coming, 1% milk.
and a package of snack cakes from a vending machine going away, and sliced apples will be on the plate. So that's an idea of how things might look on the plate
Fantastic.
In cafeterias across the country. And that's something to think about for us adults as well.
It certainly is.
And take a look at the plate.
Right. Take a look at the plate. Make sure your produce is there. And I guess that'd be the good thing to leave it on for the holidays is, you know, as you're considering how you're going to be eating, cut up the fruit, cut up the veggies, have those available. So even if you have your sweets, you're just not as apt to eat as much of them.
Yeah. And if it's there and it's out and it's prepared and it looks good, you're in business.
Right on.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Well, happy holidays.
Same to you.
Happy New Year. And my calendar looks like January 12th will be the next time.
Sounds great.
We'll be together. So thank you so much. Susan Kundrot, she joins us on the second Wednesday of the month to talk about diet and nutrition.